Management Company of Nebraska, Inc. Good morning, Mr. Domina.
May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. Today, the Bauermeister and Deaver families ask this court to end the reign of terror of the rule against perpetuities and to join courts across the country that have moved away from that rule. I took a look while preparing to be with you today at the last 25 years of jurisprudence with a Westlaw all cases search using the query I placed on the screen before you.
I beg your pardon, can you move the screen a little bit to face
yes,
the bench?
Can.
Thank you.
I think I can. Does that work?
It works for me at this end, so.
If opposing counsel needs to move to be able to see it, you may do so.
12 jurisdictions have moved away from the rule. If I slide the page up a little bit, the court will see that one jurisdiction, Maryland, retain the rule, but because of a specific problem of statutory construction. The Bogert citation to Bogert on Trusts is a good catalog of the trends of the law in this area. Your Honors, there's a Mississippi Supreme Court case decided in our briefs that lays out the real reasons why the rule against perpetuities has fallen into such disfavor. You have noted in previous decisions that you will avoid perpetuities issues wherever you can. The Mississippi case describes effectively a wait-and-see approach to the problem of perpetuities, saying instead of striking them as theoretical, we'll see if a problem develops.
In a certain time frame.
In a reasonable time frame. Guided now by a statute which other courts have found to strengthen their rationales when they were in circumstances like you are today, where you're dealing with a contract made before the effective date of the state, Nebraska, here's adoption of the Uniform Rule Against Perpetuities. And that statute, of course, adopts elements of the wait-and-see doctrine, and it also adopts elements of the doctrine that allows courts to imply judicial savings clauses to avoid perpetuities problems. This particular case arises from a 1989 contract that is a very interesting document. The option at issue is in paragraph 30. Paragraph 20 of the contract makes the option itself alienable. It permits the parties to sell their interests in the option.
After how many years?
I don't recall that there's a limitation on the number of years. There may be, but I don't recall it. It seems to me they can sell that option, as I recall it, from the beginning, and the sale can occur at any time before the exercise date.
I think there's something in the briefs about it being alienable after 10 years, is that?
You may be right about that. You may be. But it's well within lives and being plus 21. Of that I'm certain. There's also another interesting provision of the contract I'd like to direct your attention to, and that's in paragraph 8. Paragraph 8 includes a provision in which the sellers of this farm retained the right to farm all of the portion of the property not devoted to use as a landfill throughout the period of time of the purchaser's ownership. The record at trial, consisting of the testimony of the two living sellers, Mrs. Bauermeister and Mrs. Deaver, is absolutely uncontradicted that if there had not been an option, if there had not been a retained right to farm the land, this transaction would never have occurred. A lease was contemplated. The reason a lease was not used was because regulators would not issue a landfill permit to waste unless they had title to the real estate. So we have a case now, unlike 1622, when the rule against perpetuities came down in the Duke of Norfolk's case. And there, we didn't have a landfill requiring a permit, the use of which was followed by a mandatory 30-year monitoring period like we have here. There was no such thing as an imposed obligation that could, by its very legal terms, exceed 21 years. and therefore theoretically exceed lives in being plus 21. The law has changed so much in a regulatory context, particularly in environmental areas, that the rule against perpetuity causes collisions now with needs to regulate for the benefit of the environment, this being one of them. There are a number of courts that said it doesn't make rational sense to apply the rule against perpetuities to commercial transactions, where the parties negotiate at arm's length with equal bargaining power, with a view toward the long term about how they want to use the property, can envision the end of that use, and can consciously and deliberately provide for the return of the property with an option. These parties did that. They were free to contract, subject only now to a claim belated about the rule against perpetuities, a claim perhaps driven by the fact that the parties now know that the methane gas produced in this landfill may be worth more money than the landfill ever was. So we're asking the court to adopt the wait-and-see approach or imply a judicial savings clause and get us away from the harsh application of the rule against perpetuities. Now, these cases that I've cataloged for you are the decisions of doctrinal courts. There are 47 decisions cited when you look at the query that I used with Westlaw. The non-doctrinal cases do not all go our way, just as the Court of Appeals did not here. And that's because here the Court of Appeals felt obligated to follow the lead that you laid down in a 1911 decision, Rice versus Lincoln and Northwest Railroad. We think the Court of Appeals misread your decision in that case, and even it supports our position, but I think that the difference between doctrinal and non-doctrinal pronouncements outlined by this kind of a search discloses that the doctrinal courts are not coming down where the Court of Appeals did. Let me comment for just a moment on the Rice case, which was pivotal to...
Before you get to Rice and what it does or what it doesn't mean, or it... Well, this document is entered into a few months before the legislature adopted the uniform rule.
May to August, correct.
Okay, and so the parties seem to be in agreement. I guess I'll ask this of opposing counsel, that the common law is the applicable law.
We have tried the case, briefed the case, and argued the case to this point on that basis, and I think that's their position. It is ours.
Is this a question of what the doctrinal court of Nebraska would have ruled in March of 89?
Well, you're passing now on a legal question that arises from the document in 89, so I think it's a 2010 issue. It will govern all contracts, deeds, or other instruments that are dated before August of 1989, before the statute became effective.
What and we say about this document in question controls that universe of deals.
I think it does, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that in a case that arises after August of 89 and presents a perpetuities issue, you'll be guided by the statute. And here you'll be controlled by the statute. Here you may be guided or assisted by it, but you're not governed by it.
And what do you think that the law is or should be under the uniform rule starting in August of 89?
Well, the statute does two things. The first one is that it does adopt, as the Mississippi court describes very effectively, it adopts elements of the wait-and-see doctrine. It contains specific provisions describing circumstances where a court can imply savings clauses, and it essentially would give us the result we want to get. We believe we would clearly prevail under the statute. We think it's the common law rule that's the problem for us.
So are you asking us to make the statute retroactive?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I am not. The legislature didn't. All I'm asking you to do is to make a doctrinal pronouncement on the rule against perpetuities consistent with the large movement of the law in our direction, with or without the statute.
On this list of cases, some of those are decided after those states have uniform rules?
Some are and some are not. For the most part, the states adopted the uniform statute between 85 and 89. Those are the dates I recall.
Doctrinal pronouncement is what? What are you asking this court?
That the rule against perpetuities does not apply strictly, that it will be avoided where possible, that instead of making a prospective decision from the date of contracting, the court will adopt a wait-and-see approach to see if a perpetuities problem develops. Where the original contracting parties exercise the option, no perpetuities problem develops. That's the case here, so we prevail. I might also add, Your Honor, as you consider a doctrinal pronouncement, that those courts, and many courts, that have adopted a rule that permits an implied savings clause, say that the court should construe the contract to effectuate the intent of the parties. Where it's clear that the parties intended for there to be a valid option, you'll look for every way you can to give effect to that intent. In this case, that's a very clear expression in this contract. And this contract has a savings clause, which says if any part of it is invalid, the rest is valid. So the parties clearly were trying to protect their bargain and avoid the loss of this option, which was the core component of the transaction for the Bauermeisters and the Deavers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Volkmer, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Ronald Volkmer, appearing today on behalf of Waste Management. Also present with me today are Francie Reedman and Tom Brennan as co-counsel. In the district court and in the Court of Appeals, Waste Management contended that the option to purchase, contained in paragraph 30 of the agreement, violated the common law rule against perpetuities. That was the issue that was deemed dispositive by the Court of Appeals. And then in the petition for further review filed by the appellants, the four errors assigned all boil down to the narrow issue of whether or not the repurchase option executed on March 22, 1989, violated the common law rule against perpetuities. A unanimous decision of the Court of Appeals, authored by Chief Judge Imbody, carefully, in my opinion, correctly analyzed this issue and faithfully determined that the option to purchase violated the common law rule against perpetuities. It is our position that the Court of Appeals correctly applied the law to the facts and its judgment should be affirmed. I want to look briefly, very briefly, at the option itself contained in the agreement. It is very specific. It does not need to be construed. It is unequivocal in its terms. It precisely defines the rights of the parties. It clearly and unambiguously granted the sellers an option to repurchase a 280-acre tract of land for the sum of $1. The two most critical aspects of this option are the fact that this option was not personal to the sellers. It could not be exercised. It could be exercised by the heirs and devisees or successors in interest, and that is conceded in this case by virtue of the fact of who the parties plaintiff are. The time period within which this option could be exercised is crucial for this case, and with regard to that, the agreement again is very clear. The time period within which the sellers were allowed to exercise their option. Paragraph 30 stated, sellers' option may be exercised from the date of the termination of the landfill, presumably at the time the landfill was closed or filled, until 2 years after the date of the required monitoring of the landfill pursuant to Section 16. Judge Imbody concluded, based on evidence presented with regard to the landfill post-closure monitoring period, that state and federal regulations require a 30-year landfill post-closure monitoring period. I believe that is uncontradicted by the record in this case. So the uncontested facts are that this option was not limited to the lives of the sellers. It was, in property terms, in fee simple. And the date upon which it could be exercised was a date unknown. It wasn't certain when the landfill would be, quote, terminated, when it would be filled, but within 2 years plus the required monitoring period, the option, by its terms, remained open.
Could the option be sold?
Pardon me?
Could the option be sold?
The Section 20 of the agreement refers to sale or encumbrance of premises Seller agrees that it will not in any manner sell, alienate, mortgage, or encumber their option rights contained in paragraph 30.
They won't encumber them.
Sale.
I beg your
pardon. Not sell. That's what the agreement said in paragraph
30. So in your view, this document does not permit the sellers to sell the option. Is that your view?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's dispositive of the case. I believe the fact
but
was...
But it might go to how the option is characterized. I mean, is it a contract or is it an encumbrance on land?
Well, we're clearly arguing that it is a contingent future interest subject to the rule against perpetuities and affects an interest in land. It is not, quote, a mere contractual right. And that is historically true with regard to how an option to repurchase has been regarded
under
the common law rule.
Is it a repurchase or is it a redemption?
Well, it granted by its terms the right to repurchase land subject to a contingency. And whatever you call it, in terms of, as I say, a strictly contractual provision or an interest, obviously it affects land. It affects alienability of land. And quite frankly, if we want to talk about alienability, we need to talk about the interest conveyed to waste management and its effect on that. The common law rule against perpetuities clearly has been enforced in this state. It was on March 22, 1989.
Well, what if Mr. Domina's argument that other states are moving, other courts are moving away from this and essentially
Your
that's
Honor,
what he's urging us to
the
do?
The argument about the direction of the rule against perpetuities, I would argue to you, is basically a legislative policy decision with regard to a state's adoption of the Uniform Statutory Rule Against Perpetuities. And it could be further argued that exactly the form you're going to replace this rule with, a so-called wait-and-see doctrine, I would argue is fraught with peril. Commentators have argued there is no measuring life concept left after wait-and-see. It allows, under the Uniform Statutory Rule, one could argue greater dead-hand control of property than the common law rule allows.
What would be the outcome of this case under the Uniform Rule?
Your Honors, that's a very good question. When the Uniform Statutory Rule became law in this state in the 1980s, I addressed the question in a seminar of whether or not, by its very terms, this act would apply to an option, such as the one we have in this case. And if you read the fine print of that act, it references donative transactions, donative transactions, donative transactions. I could stand before you tomorrow and argue that that statute does not apply to this case. I think that's a contested issue. Now, whether the policy of changing to a so-called wait-and-see doctrine in terms of, quote, a trend, in terms of whether or not that is a policy decision, again, I think it is fraught with peril in terms of reading the critical commentary of wait-and-see. Many persons suggest that you end up with a greater, if you will, a rule for perpetuities because of allowing some period of time to elapse in the future unknown.
Would you really, though, if you apply it to commercial transactions and commercial transactions that are well defined?
Well, in this case, how well defined is it, Your Honor? It in terms of the period within which we're going to wait and see, if we allow the parties to have an unlimited option with regard to when it's being exercised, and the court is going to wait and see, how long do they wait and see? Are you going to tell them in a subsequent case?
Does wait and see mean let's see what actually happens on the ground with respect to these parties?
What it does, it changes the common law rule significantly. It says we're going to look at acts, events, and circumstances occurring after the date of the creation. The historical common law rule against perpetuity says we measure the validity as of the date of the time the interest is created. We determine early whether it's void or valid.
So how did wait and see come to be so prevalent, or at least
because Mr. Domina correctly points out, Professor Leach wrote an article describing the rule's reign of terror and its application in certain cases that made it a mockery, the unborn widow, the fertile octogenarian, and the magic gravel pit that Leach wrote about in his famous article in 1938, Perpetuities in a Nutshell.
So is this fair to say that the hazards or the unpleasant outcomes or the disfavored outcomes by applying rule of perpetuities to options, the courts were responding to that and fiddling?
Well, Your Honor, what the courts were responding to, I'm not... I assume they were responding to situations in which they felt the application of the common law rule resulted in a policy that they felt was unwise. However, again, when you start tinkering with the common law rule and start trying to apply a test that is indefinite and uncertain with regard to validity and determining the status of real property's inalienability and title based upon waiting and seeing, that violates a substantial policy about the stability of land titles.
So what policy objection could there be to holding the original parties to the contract to their bargain?
What would the policy, Your Honor, allowing this indefinite period of time to go for 30 years, and it's minimally 32 years, the judge pointed out, at the time of the creation, that was the minimal time period. During that period of time, there are substantial costs on the alienability of this land. It does, to some degree, represent the policy determination about control of property by persons long deceased. It does affect alienability of land.
When applying a wait-and-see approach, what do the courts look at as far as pertinent, relevant facts, and how do they apply such a rule?
Well, Your Honor, quite frankly, we haven't got that many decisions, in my opinion, really answering that question satisfactorily to me about how the courts, as I ask you rhetorically, how long are you going to wait and see? The uniform statutory rule says 90 years. I'm not in favor of that, personally, and I think it's a matter of policy. That's part of the peril of going down the road Mr. Domina has respectfully suggested. And
does that alienate it longer than under the common law rule?
Well, all I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that it makes the stability of the title uncertain for a substantial period of time. Indefinite, we don't know. It will promote litigation, in my opinion.
Under the uniform act, what is the restatement position as to what would happen under the Uniform Act?
If you look at the restatement second.
No, I mean the restatement third. I'm sorry.
Restatement third, in my opinion, with regard to, you have to be careful in reading it with regard to donative transfers and the limited scope of either the Uniform Statutory Rule or the restatement rules, limiting it to donative transfers. And to the extent it is, if you will, neutral, or better yet, it doesn't necessarily specifically address the kind of option that's involved in this case.
Is this a donative transfer?
The Uniform Statutory Rule refers to donative transfers. The modern restatements refer to donative transfers.
I meant this option in this contract that we're discussing. Is that a donative transfer?
Well, again, Mr. Domina has indicated that the Uniform Statutory Rule and modern restatements endorse a wait-and-see concept. My problem with that is substantial with regard to whether that is good policy, but you have to back up a step and determine whether these authorities are actually applying that new rule to what are essentially non-donative transfers.
What's this one?
Well, this is clearly not a donative transfer. This is bargain for consideration in the context of a contract.
Thank you.
Your Honor, we believe that the Court of Appeals correctly analyzed this case, and its judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes.
We have no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next.